And we do ask if you have a comment that you identify yourself. So we can put the recording onto our website under our rulemaking docket. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board. This is the September 20th meeting of the Rules Subcommittee of the Campaign Finance Board. It's anticipated that the last meeting of the Rules Subcommittee meeting, which is our subcommittee, which I think is met with General Glee, about staff, and the two board members who will participate. We're going to go through the three sets of rules that we have. We've received some more comments, and in reaction to those comments, made some additional changes, which we'd like to explain to you. Jody Pope will be doing that. Before we get going, though, we've had some comments that indicate maybe a little confusion as to where we're at in the process. So, if you wouldn't mind pulling out your rulemaking progress chart, let me kind of deal with this for just a minute. We are in what we would call the third step. The agency develops the rules and so on. The SONAR is a statement of need and reasonableness, which explains the rationale for the various rules that the board is looking at here. And Jody has been, you know, busy taking notes and in the background starting to build that document. We're taking the comments, the rules subcommittee is taking the comments to finalize the form of the rules that will then be proposed to the full board in October. That meeting is on October the 4th, which is a Wednesday. At that meeting, the full board will have a discussion on the rules, and we'll go through the rationale, and frankly, we'll at some point, I presume October, although perhaps November, depending on what happens at the October meeting, but I assume at the October meeting, we'll then authorize that portion, whether it be all or some of the rules that are presented to it, as the board's rulemaking package. We'll also, I assume, provide me with authority to then do the next steps, whether that's developing a notice for the governor, developing a notice of intent to adopt rules, and then would say to you that we are not finished with the process of receiving comments on the rules after this meeting. If any of you wanted to provide either a written comment based on what comes out of this meeting, or in fact present to the board at October 4th, that is certainly your right. And if you are interested in doing so, please let me know so I can schedule some time to make that presentation. And with that, I think I can turn it over to Jody, and we can kind of start moving through the rules.
All right, I'm going to start with the expenditures and the non-campaign disbursement rules, and I'm just going to cover the items that are highlighted in yellow because those are the only things that have changed since our last meeting.
But I would also encourage you, if there is something as you're going through that you'd like to come back and comment on, that would be fine to raise that as an issue.
The first change was on page one, on subpart one, there for reimbursements. This part is intended to clarify confusion that we've seen about whether you need to, when you have a reimbursement, whether you need to itemize that expenditure when the underlying expenses to the vendor are over $200 or when the amount to the person that you're reimbursing is over $200. And originally we had the rules drafted so that the itemization threshold applied when the amount paid to the vendor was over $200. But in discussions with some of our treasurers and internally, we realized that wasn't going to provide the disclosure that we were really looking for, so we needed to flip that and make the itemization threshold apply when the person being reimbursed is receiving more than $200 in the calendar year. The next change was under subpart three on page one to cellular telephone plans. I think originally, at the very beginning, we started with the committee, if it was going to pay for the candidate's cell phone, had to get a single user plan. And then in response to comments, we said that you could use a multi-user plan, but you had to track the candidate's expenses. And again, in response to comments about how things, you know, how the volunteer treasurer's life works, we added a second option there that would allow the treasurer to divide the cost of the multi-user plan by the number of lines on the plan as an alternative way to determine the candidate's use. The next change is on page 2 in subpart 5. The reason that this subpart is there is because the statute requires committees to disclose the purpose of their expenditures. And we've had some questions about exactly what do you need to show the purpose. And so this language was changed. It used to say that you had to describe the good or service purchased. But we thought, again, in response to comments that we received, that that might not really get a detailed enough explanation of what the money actually went for. So that language has been changed so that the committee would explain how the good or service was used. And then hopefully that will give us more detail about the expenditure.
I think you made an example there. The example that was brought to us as well, if the vendor is Delta Airlines and the item is an airline ticket, the way the rule was drafted, that would be sufficient then under the rule, but really that doesn't tell us what we know to confirm it was in fact appropriate. We also want to know that it was used to attend a national conference for which something like that affects. So that's the additional information.
And that was the last change to this batch of rules since the last meeting. Did anyone have any questions about any other provisions? Should I go to the second set? Okay. The second set is the draft disclaimer and non-expenditure provisions. The first change highlighted in yellow there is the addition of a new subpart to the rule. And this came about because the board initially was pursuing some technical changes to the rules, and those changes, the rule parts with those changes, were enacted into statute, and then the rule was repealed. So the reviser of statutes notified us that, for example, on page 1 there, 4501.0500 subpart B, that subpart 2 had been repealed. So did we want to repeal that entire sub-item? Well, the answer is no, because subpart 2 was codified. So what we really want to do is remove the reference to its old location and substitute in the new statutory location of those requirements. Under securities, there are a couple new changes there. Under subpart 2, in response to comments about annuities, we added annuities to the list of things which are not securities, and then added defined benefit in front of pension plan and took out retirement to make it more clear that did not include 401ks, that 401k, your holdings in a 401k should be something that you would be disclosing, you know, subject to our changes on mutual funds.
And here I think we do want to stop and have a discussion. Mr. Mullen has some concerns about whether or not we do in fact want to exclude annuities, or if we want to go with the approach of having them list annuities but not the underlying holdings of any annuities. Would you mind kind of explaining what you're thinking there?
Sure. The existing law has a disclosure of holdings in mutual funds, for example. This annuity issue came about as a result of a discussion with the legislature, whether or not they ought to be included. When we're dealing with mutual funds, it's really not an area that the state plays any kind of significant regulatory role in. It's mostly regulated by the SEC, and the state's participation in mutual fund regulation is primarily to collect registration fees for funds you want to sell in the state. There's very little that the legislature can do, or anyone can do, regarding mutual funds. On the other hand, annuities are highly regulated by the state. They are not regulated federally. They are regulated by states. They are an insurance product. And it seems to me that when we're dealing with, for example, today, an attorney general who has been very active in prosecuting annuity cases, or a Department of Commerce that is very active in looking at enforcement of annuities, we might want to know whether or not someone owns an annuity. And so, for 90% of the people we are currently asking economic interest statements to come in from, I have no interest in knowing whether they own an annuity. But there is a percentage here of people who do impact the annuity market. In 2013, there was a huge piece of legislation before the legislature involving the sale and marketing of annuity products. And so I have some concern about deleting them from this area. And I realize that there are good arguments as to why they should be. But to me, it's not obvious that we should now not require the disclosure of annuities. That does not mean I would require the disclosure of the underlying holdings of the annuity. I don't care about those particularly. That's my position.
I think you make a good argument. My question would be the likelihood of somebody holding an annuity that was not from Minnesota, not at Minnesota Hall. I don't see any reason why we should require the listing of an annuity coming from some other state.
If they sell annuities in the state, they are regulated in the state. Even if they're out of state, a company selling annuities to Minnesota residents is here. So I understand the differentiation between Minnesota companies and non-Minnesota companies. But I believe, and I'm not certain on this, I'd have to double check it, but I believe if you are an out-of-state company selling annuities in the state, you have to register with the Department of Commerce. I think.
Well, registering with the Department of Commerce is a little different from having any kind of control over the underlying assets in the annuity.
That's absolutely right, but if for example the Department of Commerce or the Attorney General's office receives 200 complaints regarding the sale of an annuity by a company from outside the state of Minnesota, and they decide not to pursue an action, and one was to discover that the commissioner of the department or the attorney general held annuities in that company, I'd still have a concern about whether or not the public wants to know that. So that's...
Well, perhaps that's an argument for a tiered disclosure.
As I mentioned, I don't think that I don't want to have to require people in the watershed districts to tell us about their life with annuities. We don't need the information. I don't think the public is interested in that. But how one develops that tiered approach is a very challenging process, and I think we're going to work on it, and I think we should work on it, and I think we should find a way to make sure that people get information they need, and we don't just gather information that gathers dust because it's irrelevant. So,
Bob, under the approach that you're suggesting, then I think under subpart one, which is items which are securities, you would then insert annuities after mortgage. And then on items which are not securities, you would add the language underlying holdings foreign.
Actually, could I modify that a little bit? I think it would be to add annuities in subpart one, but then in holders of securities, subpart three, I think it would be cleaner than, you see how it, add an extra sentence saying an individual owning interest in an annuity does not have an ownership interest in the underlying securities owned by the annuity, because then it's in the same place as the mutual fund, and it's the same place as the trust.
So could you add it right after mutual fund? And would you own putting shares in the mutual fund? I suppose that's what that is.
I'd probably just add an extra sentence. You know, it'd just be clearer to add the extra sentence there.
That's fine. Let me just, let me just say that this is sort of inside baseball, because in the five or six hearings we've had, I don't think we've received one comment from anybody on this issue. This is, you know, you are primarily here because of the independent expenditure rules, and we get that. But I think, in fairness to the public, this debate that we are having internally ought to be shared. And so I don't think we're going to go wrong as a board in this area, and because I don't think people are going to be offended either way necessarily, because we just haven't received public comments on it. But anyway, that's how one adjusts it. I don't care. And again, the board may well reject my analysis anyway. So it, we'll see where it goes.
Let's incorporate that.
Those two changes. Okay, so I'm switching annuities from subpart two to subpart one. So it is the security, and then I'm going to add a sentence to subpart three, saying that, you know, just because you own an annuity doesn't mean that you're the holder of securities and the underlying interest. All right.
And doesn't say that you don't have to disclose the underlying.
It doesn't state that specifically, but that's the way it operates when you read it in conjunction with the statutes that govern disclosure, is that you would have to disclose that you own the annuity, but you wouldn't have to disclose the underlying holdings held by the annuity. So. The next change is on page two, subpart six. This is the language for the exception for blind trusts. So if you were the beneficiary of a blind trust, you wouldn't have to disclose the assets held by the trust, because you're not supposed to know what those are. The next change is at the bottom of page two, and this is another conforming change suggested by the reviser. It's another part where there was a rule part that got codified, and the reviser wanted to eliminate the rule reference, but we're simply replacing that with the reference to the statute. The next changes are to disclaimers on page three. And the changes, a lot of the changes were driven by some comments that pointed out that the statute has a specific format for a disclaimer in a broadcast media communication, and the rules did not account for that. So on page four, there's now a new subpart five, which has the form of the disclaimer for an independent expenditure that's broadcast. And then to make it clear that the disclaimers in subparts one through four didn't apply to broadcast communications, the word written was added to those subparts. The other change that was made is, again, in, for example, subpart one, the language in the disclaimer was changed a little bit to say it is not coordinated with or approved by any candidate. And the reason for that change was to incorporate some language from the coordinated expenditure rules, because coordinated is kind of the new word that we're trying to adopt for independent expenditures, or non-independent expenditures. So that word was added to the disclaimer. If you turn to page 4, I think the next change is the deletion of subpart 3 there at the top. And again, in response to comments and reviewing the rule, I think we realize that every independent expenditure implicitly supports one candidate and opposes another candidate. So by having language there that was supposed to be used in that situation, it could have created confusion about which disclaimer form you were supposed to use. So what we did is just take out subpart 3, and we'll let the speaker decide if the communication is mainly in support of a candidate or mainly in opposition of a candidate, and then use the correct disclaimer based on that decision. Subpart, the next subpart, I think, it has a change just to let people use a shorthand phrase if they're going to have a communication that supports more than one candidate or opposes more than one candidate.
Which part is that? Can I use that?
I think it's the whole subpart.
Oh, that's awesome.
Then subpart 5 we talked about already, that's the new broadcast media disclaimer. Oh, and then in subpart 6 and 7, which were old subpart 7 and 8 on the bottom of page 4, those were tweaked just a little bit to specify that you have to state the address of the sponsoring entity only when the communication is written.
All of this is basically in response to comments pointing out that 211B, which is the standard disclaimer for material produced by a candidate or a political committee, has a variation of a disclaimer for a media broadcast, realizing that a disclaimer that takes 30 seconds to read isn't a good idea for a radio ad. So we try to reflect that in the variation that we have here for independent expenditures and reduce the amount of information that's required for independent expenditures.
The next change is on page 5. It's in the middle of subpart 9, and it just adds the majority of to, was in response to a comment, you know, wondering if that would be all right to clarify that it just has to be in the same size as the majority of the text on the page. Subpart 11 is being deleted because we've gotten a lot of feedback from people candidates who actually use the outdoor signs, that having the high contrast color, you know, might force them to have a two-color sign or a three-color sign. It just has a lot of unintended consequences, and we couldn't craft a disclaimer requirement that would apply to every kind of outdoor sign, so it just wasn't feasible for the rule, so it's being taken out. And I believe that's the last change to this set of rules. Now we're on the coordination rules. Jeff, did you want to talk about the first change in that one? On page 2, the deletion of item B.
And then this sort of relates also to the whole issue of the what's referred to, I guess, in the campaign finance community as the B-roll issue. This is where a candidate or an independent expenditure committee basically makes use of video material, typically of a per diem sort of material, that was produced by the candidate, but then incorporates that into the independent expenditure. We already have an exception longstanding for a photograph if the candidate gets removed from the website. That's not an issue, and that's another part of the rules that's, put that into rule, that that's not a problem. That doesn't create or defeat the independent expenditure. The issue is more in terms of if there's an advertisement or commercial placed on YouTube, where would we be here in terms of viewing that as somehow breaking the independence of an expenditure that used part of that candidate's material in their advertising. Now, back up on this a little bit. Most, if not all, of the changes, I guess I would say most, the changes that you see in all three packets, all three sections of the rules, are based either on advisory opinions of the board, almost actually all on advisory opinions of the board, in terms of trying to bring that forward into an administrative rule. It's actually a statutory requirement. The statute 10A requires the board to adopt administrative rules if it believes that the content of an advisory opinion should be applied more widely than just to the individual if the opinion is issued. In this case, there is no such advisory opinion. So there are no advisory opinion dealing with the use of campaign material and commercial that's available publicly on YouTube and how that can be incorporated. There is a finding. This was in early years, either late 2014 or early 2015, a complaint was filed by the Republican Party against the DFL Party and Governor Dayton's re-election committee. And the basis of the complaint was that there was a commercial developed by the DFL as an independent expenditure in support of Governor Dayton. That commercial used a small snippet of a commercial that had been used by, produced, I should say, by Governor Dayton 4 years prior. In other words, not at his re-election, but rather when he initially ran for governor 4 years prior. The part of the video didn't have any voiceover by the governor. It was basically a picture of the governor, a short video piece of the governor sitting on the steps with the children. It's a cute shot, but that was the whole point. In that case, the board found that it was not a violation, or it did not defeat the independence of that expenditure, but then went on to say, if the video clip, which was 3 seconds in length, was longer than 3 seconds, and if the video hadn't been 4 years old, a different conclusion might have been reached. Well, that is a pretty difficult finding to base an administrative rule, because frankly, I think it indicates that the board wasn't quite sure where to draw the line. I guess what I'm trying to say here is I don't think this issue is going away, but without a board advisory opinion or a strong finding in which to point to, I think we're now looking at sort of a cutting edge here. And to me, as an administrator, that sounds like policy. And that's something that I think then we should take to the legislature, if the board wishes to, as a legislative recommendation to determine what, if any, standard should be applied. Certainly when the, going even further back to the last session, there was some interest, in fact, there was legislation that was going to limit the board's ability to do administrative rules. And one of the arguments that I made is that historically, and I do believe this is a true statement, historically the board has not adopted administrative rules that could be seen as developing new policy. It's been basically backfilling policy that was set by the legislature, or in rare occasion, moving forward with, again, advisory opinions. This no longer feels this way to me at all. I'm not the board. It'll be the board's decision as to what to do here. And I do realize that there are certainly associations who are interested in trying to address this issue. And I acknowledge it as an important issue. I just believe that at this point it's beyond the scope of things.
I think there's one other change, or two other short changes to the rule. Should I go over those and then we'll throw it open to comments?
Sure.
Okay. The next change is on page 3 to item D, and this was talked about at the last meeting, about when you have a spender that was established by someone related to the candidate, or associated with the candidate, you know, where should you draw the line in deciding whether or not that expenditure is coordinated or not? And so what this part does is it says that it's going to be coordinated if the spender isn't a party unit and it was established or organized or directed or managed during the same election cycle by the candidate, and that would include the candidate's agent or the candidate's committee. Somebody who meets the definition of candidate, you know, at some time during the election cycle, the candidate's spouse, and then that would be the list. And so the other changes to this part, like deleting the rest of the family members, to leave it to spouse, and then sub-item I, making sure that it's clear that it doesn't apply to the spouse of the candidate's agent, are all intended to kind of implement that line that we talked about.
Sure, just for a second. I know there was interest in removing the spouse as well. On that one, I know you had some pretty strong thoughts there as a former candidate. And I have talked to some members of the legislature on that. And while they're concerned with the general direction, I think they understood that this is actually pretty important. And remember, this isn't saying that the candidate's spouse can't be involved with the political committee. It's not saying that the candidate's spouse can't be involved with the party unit. It's really just saying that the candidate's spouse cannot manage or direct an independent expenditure committee. And even then, that's okay. It's the problem is that independent expenditure committee then turns around and makes an independent expenditure in support of the spouse's spouse, which made any sense. But at any rate, the candidate, at that point, then, it just was stretching credibility to say that there wouldn't be any ability or shouldn't be any presumption here that the spouse would have any knowledge about the campaign. I haven't run into a single candidate who said that, well, my spouse doesn't have any knowledge at all about the campaign. There's certainly different levels of involvement. Some may even look at the campaign with some disdain, but they certainly still know about what's going on and are aware of the status of the campaign. So that's why, at least at this point, the recommendation is to leave the spouse. There was one other comment, Joe, which I think should be considered. I don't know if Bob and Peggy have, any interest, but one comment from Mr. Beck on his latest letter was that it might be appropriate to put spouse or partner, recognizing that the marital status is probably really not the issue.
No, I think that's a good idea. I think that's a good addition.
Jeff, this issue, obviously, we received comments from the Chamber of Commerce and looked at those cases and can have a discussion about that if you want. But did this section come out of any administrative or advisory opinion, like 410, 412, 400? Is this something that we've issued an advisory opinion for on?
No, the board has done a number of advisory opinions looking at what is an agent, but I don't think it's looked at the family issue.
And what is it that, I'm sorry, but what, why is it that we can proceed in the policy area here, but you're hesitant to do it in Section B?
Well, that's a good point. Perhaps we should here as well. If you think back to the initial petition that was brought to the board that started this whole process, it included a request from Mr. Beck that he looked at this petition. And it was an issue that at least at one time was decided to go forward with and see if there could be something.
I don't want to create false hopes here. I took a look at the cases that were provided by the Chamber of Commerce on this issue, and I wasn't persuaded by them, and I'll tell you why, because I want to be straightforward. First of all, I think the Beardsley case is not particularly helpful, but the other case, which dealt with an extraordinarily dysfunctional relationship, it was a fascinating read, really pointed to the Florida statute at the end. And our statute is different than the Florida statute. And so I thought that I didn't think it created a circumstance that we needed to follow or should follow necessarily, because it was really, I can point to the specific paragraph if you want. There was a specific paragraph that cites to just that statute, and that's the Valeri case. And it's in paragraph 77, where the legislature had precluded the use of a one factor. That's, I don't believe, the case in Minnesota. So while the case is fascinating and creates a discussion, I don't think it overcomes necessarily our ability to have spousal limitations in here. And the other thing I would just note for the record is I think this will be a discussion at the board level, but you also cited to one place New York statutes, which I looked at, and you cited to it on a different issue, but nevertheless, in looking at that, I note that New York creates a coordination problem around immediate families, which is even a broader term than spouses. So I think that if we're going to rely on New York law, we may find, if we use New York law in this area, which is not necessarily what you intended us to do, it may take us to a broader definition. So I wanted to acknowledge the fact that you provided that information, that it was read, that we're looking at it, that it's considered, and I wanted to thank you for providing it.
Thank you. Do you want to keep talking about families, or should
I just add?
Sure.
You were going to put in
or partner.
Oopsie.
We'll have to find it.
And we would need to do it in two places, both the line that's in yellow, spouse or partner of the candidate's agent.
Yeah. And we'll have to probably add a definition of partner, and because otherwise we have too much discretion.
I'm not sure.
So we'll have to find something that the ALJ will accept, or maybe there's a definition somewhere else in statute, which would be the best case scenario, because then we can refer to that definition. Otherwise, we'll have to come up with some definition.
Yeah, partner is pretty broad. It can be a business partner. It could be a very different situation.
Yeah,
I think, I just want to verify that that's not what you're referring to. That I think we're talking about cohabitating.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Cohabitating part.
How is that? Take something out, or wait till the end. Okay, so I just want to say
you
that.
Can identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Stacy Stout with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I do want to just point out that in this language, you're making a presumption that if you're married, then you're an agent. So just would like for you to consider how somebody would have the opportunity to show that they are not in fact an agent of the campaign. So you allow for a rebuttable presumption. So just want to throw that out there for thought. You'll probably see that in other areas of the law.
Do you have to be an agent?
Well, this language is making you an agent. So you are presumed an agent by the fact that you're married.
Yeah, for this one item only. You're not presumed to be an agent, like for item A or item C or item E, F, or G. You're just an agent for item D.
So you're an agent of the campaign.
Well, like you're saying, you're effectively making the spouse an agent, and that's probably true, but only for purposes of the item D. So like, for example, if you look at item A as the fundraising one, where the candidate can't fundraise for a spender, but the candidate's spouse could fundraise for the spender.
Oh, I see the distinction.
Yeah. So it's only for this one where we're saying if the candidate's spouse makes this, you know, committee, and then that committee does it, then it's coordinated.
So in this instance, though, it is presumed. So you might want to consider if somebody needed to lay out the facts as to why they weren't, then you allow for that.
And you also sort of raised that issue in your letter. Suggesting that in certain laws, the burden is placed on the person paying for the communication of terms. So if we get into this issue of burdens and presumptions, I don't know where that's going to end. I mean, we could deal with that in every category. And so once we open the door to that, then we've really created less clarity in some ways. And the goal, as I've understood this, is to take our advisory opinions and try to provide clarity to candidates. Now, whether or not one has the right to seek a waiver from the rule, some way in advance, maybe, I don't know. But if I went into presumption business, I got nothing. You know, there's presumption, but there's no clear lines. So I don't know. I mean, I appreciate the comment. I think it's very thoughtful. I just don't know how to do it. I'll think about it. I'll try to figure out.
I would say that in all scenarios, the board would have completed an investigation, even if it was apparently a violation of the administrative rules, if there were mitigating factors that would consider it's always possible that technical violation of the rules and the statute would be imposed because there would be factors in the sorts of board would consider this.
But do we have an ability to have people seek a waiver in advance? I mean, if a spouse came in and said, you know, I want to run this independent committee. We have a dysfunctional family. I haven't been with my spouse for years. I think he's a nice guy. I think he'd be a good candidate. I want to contribute to him. Is there a way that in advance of those contributions going in, that spouse could come to the board and say, you know, I've read your rule, but you have to understand the circumstances here. Can I get a waiver under these circumstances? Can we do that?
I don't know that we have the authority to say the administrative rule is implied because of the following factors. I think after the evaluation and investigation, you could say that the walls were maintained, there was no communication prior during the fitting campaign. I think you can use that as a basis to say that there was perhaps more technical violation than natural violation. In advisory opinion, maybe I should back up. The advisory opinion does provide a safe harbor to those who ask. So I suppose, in theory, we could come up with an advisory opinion that says, can this be interpreted to the following actions provide protection for the famous part of the administration? I'm not sure the board would go there, but I guess if you can break safe harbor, you can break safe harbor.
If I could just add one thing. So we had put this in our earlier letter. You could provide a list of conditions that, if satisfied, would overcome the assumption of coordination when a family member is involved, as the board has done with the proposed rules related to the distribution of campaign materials and the use of common consultants. So you do provide for rebuttable presumption in other areas. So that's all I wanted to point out. I do want to point out, just with your example, the spouse could be wanting to be in an IE opposing their spouse as well. So there's lots of scenarios here that we just want to make sure that we're not forgetting any of those.
It's interesting to me that that is the issue which the chamber is focused on.
I think it was because of how it originally started with the long list of relatives. And so then once we realized this could be a concern down the road, we don't, just felt like it was worth pointing those out.
Change that we haven't talked about change to H was, Jeff kind of talked about that with, because that's related to the change to B. That was the flip side where the candidate takes material that was used in an independent expenditure. And I think the major concern there was that the candidate could take something that was produced by a corporation, which would turn that into a criminal violation on the corporation without the corporation's knowledge or participation. The other change there is in subpart 11, item D, and this, again, was in response to comments just to make it clear that candidates can complete and return surveys conducted by different groups so that the groups can decide whether or not they want to endorse that candidate.
That actually is pretty much the exact language in the statute. We're just including in the rule that really goes out of the statutory statement saying that the endorsement process is not part of the endorsement. Was there any impression that we had requests for?
Yeah, I think Mr. Harper wanted to talk or present formally.
Yeah, my name is Nick Harper. I'm with the League of Women Voters. I'm their Civic Engagement Manager. Thank you for allowing me to speak. We had questions about the reason for making the changes, but those have been explained here today. Our only request would be that that is clarified in the meeting minutes, for example, that those changes were made because it is not, that the board has, or the committee has decided that is a policy issue left to the legislature. If that could be clarified and put in writing, we would love that. Thank you.
Well, that's a very fair statement. I think Joey and I both realize that we got a little brief here in our comments on the side. So we will certainly let
thank you.
And let me just say from my standpoint, I'm not sure I'm going to agree with that analysis when we get to the board hearing. And so please understand that even if these minutes reflect the staff sense that this may be a policy issue, I may, as a board member, take the position that no, it makes little sense to create half a rule. Policy standpoint. Why bother? Why are we doing that? Why should the board give up its discretion to consider these matters based on putting forward a rule that is hollow? So I don't, you know, I want to dive into that issue of whether or not this is a policy determination and what our authority is. And I may end up agreeing wholeheartedly with Jeff. I have the utmost respect for his logic and thinking, and he's done a great job. But on the other hand, as a board member, I may disagree.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Which I think kind of brings us full circle, unless anyone else has another comment or any items they wish to bring forward. We will have final version here that we'll post to the website to our make the docket incorporating the changes we just went through. Additional comments, and again, if anyone here wishes to make a presentation to the full board, as October 4th, please let me know. We'll probably limit any presentation to 5 or 10 minutes at maximum, but you certainly have a right to do that to the full board. Because it is going to be the full board's decision as to how we go forward from there. Again, thank you very much for attending. I know you spent a lot of days at hand. But we do appreciate we've received so many comments, and I truly do believe that we have a better product coming out of this than we can use to do this.
I'm really glad there are organizations that are paying attention and give pushback. Makes us think about it when we do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.